This is why I'm so in on my tinfoil hat, because I think that a lot of people are genuinely confused as to like what this debate is about.
Yeah.
Because if the American Economic Liberties Project was called the Technocratic Regulators Can Improve on Market Outcomes Institute, then nobody would be confused. It's a debate about what it means to be a center-left political party, should be to be like a capitalism and welfare state party, or it should be a central planning party.
Hi, my name is Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And welcome to The Argument. It's a show where two friends argue about politics, policy, and whatever else we're interested in that week. This week, Matt and I are going to talk about Spirit Airlines.
Yes, Spirit
Not
Airlines.
Not great.
It's bankrupt. This is interesting. I mean, I think we want to talk about what actually happened with this airline. But also, I think that some of the political arguments about this are like a skeleton key for understanding like really big ideological divides in America in a way that people don't totally understand.
Yeah.
But first, we had an airline.
No longer exists. It's bankrupt.
It's gone. So Spirit, for I don't know if those don't know, it was what we call an ultra low cost carrier. It's a cheap airline. ULCCs focus mostly on like price sensitive leisure travelers, tourists, things like that. They do point to point service. Spirit is one of the older ones in the United States. So, you know, its elimination is sort of significant.
Yeah. And like the proximate cause of this is obviously the Iran war.
Well,
like, the Strait of Hormuz has been closed for, like, what, like, 6 weeks now? How long has it been?
It's been a while,
since
I last took a super tanker through it. No, it's
10 weeks, actually. And, like, and then, you know, the 20% of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. Obviously, it's going to raise jet fuel costs. Jet fuel is, like, 20% of the cost of airlines' largest expense after labor. And, you know, the cost of jet fuel is roughly doubled at this point. So,
yes.
Seems bad. That's what they're citing in their bankruptcy documents.
Right. I mean, to back it up, so Spirit had been going on for a while. Its business model had been ailing for a while. JetBlue, which is a different airline, tried to buy them when Joe Biden was president. The Justice Department argued that this would be an antitrust problem. They got a federal judge to agree. The acquisition was blocked. Spirit then went bankrupt pretty soon after. There's like multiple kinds of bankruptcy. There's like two main ones for companies, Chapter 11 and Chapter 7. In a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you like shrug off your old debts. You can rewrite leases, is important for airlines. You can like screw over your workers on things you'd promised to pay them. Airlines are filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy like all the time because it's one of the only ways they can reduce their cost structure. So Spirit did a Chapter 11. They emerged from Chapter 11. They then did another Chapter 11. They emerged from that. And then jet fuel prices spiked.
So there's like a huge debate happening right now about like what actually is the cause of Spirit's bankruptcy, which is like what we're kind of getting into here. Like Spirit, as I said, is like nominally citing, and it is like the last knife was definitely the jet fuel prices. Like it was, they were like very exposed to this. They were already in a bad position, but this was like, I don't know, like the nail in the coffin.
Yes.
But like now there's like all this discourse. Like I was just listening to like a podcast on The Blaze this morning. So it was these two comedian, or I guess like, I don't know, it's a comedy podcast, but they were, you know, on the right, and they were basically entirely attributing this demise of Spirit to the, DOJ suit to prevent Spirit from merging with JetBlue under the Biden administration. And like the like argument that's like really burgeoning both on the right, like, you know, Sean Duffy, transportation secretary for the Trump administration, is really saying this, but also, you know, lots of people are saying this online. And you know, elected officials are arguing this too, that the Biden administration like made an anti-capitalist, like anti-market, like anti-competitive decision to allow for Spirit Airlines to, or to prevent Spirit Airlines from being able to merge with JetBlue. And like, there's kind of like this like, well, like, look what happened. So like, you didn't let them merge, but now it doesn't even exist. So the benefits that you were supposed to get of Spirit Airlines continuing to be this like pressure to prevent price increases like no longer exist.
Right. Well, so I that second argument I think makes a lot more sense than the first, right? But what they're literally saying, like I saw, you know, there was an AI cartoon and it's like Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren are like the pallbearers at the Spirit Airlines funeral.
There's just two of them?
And they're jumping around. I think so.
Pretty strong.
yeah, they're strong guys. So In a literal sense, clearly, it's the increase in jet fuel is why Spirit is liquidating. Like, that's the difference between today and 2 months ago. In a counterfactual sense, I mean, it seems likely, actually, that if the purchase had gone through, right, JetBlue has been losing money since this time anyway. Spirit is also losing money. If they had merged, JetBlue would have taken on Spirit's debts, and it also would have incurred costs, because when you buy an airline, you know, you need to repaint all the planes, so on and so forth. They would have made this purchase not knowing that Trump was going to start a war with Iran that was going to spike the price of jet fuel. And so the combined entity would almost certainly be bankrupt now.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a very plausible argument people are making. Like, I do not feel like I have the necessary business expertise to know if that's true or not. But I do think that it's one thing that's relevant is that Spirit also made, I mean, a bunch of interesting business decisions. So after it wasn't, and you know, the JetBlue merger was also like super controversial at the time. Like even, you know, within Spirit, there were like concerns that JetBlue's merger was just definitely not going to be allowed and that they should just not, the shareholders should not accept the merger. But they, you know, they were drawn in by the massive potential payout that they were going to get an exit for accepting that. But I think that, like, you know, this point was that after the merger was blocked by, you know, a Reagan era judge, Spirit, like, decided to try to not just be a budget airline anymore. They were like, okay, we need to like now expand our premium offerings. I forget what they're called, like the big front seats or whatever, like some kind of like premium offerings they started doing, and they started like really trying to break up the main carrier. And like, obviously, like anyone who's ridden Spirit, I don't think Matt or I have ever had the privilege. I guess we'll never have the privilege at this point. Knows like the whole point is that it's like really ultra low. Like it's not meant to have any kind of like premium offering.
Yeah.
And like, it creates this weird dynamic, though, in the arguments from the, like, DOJ that were like, okay, we want to keep Spirit around because they're this ultra-low-cost carrier, but then, like, they block the merger with JetBlue, and then you get a situation where, like, Spirit thinks its only, like, pathway out of this is to no longer be just an ultra-low-cost carrier. So even if, like, the war with Iran doesn't happen and jet fuel prices don't spike, it seems unclear to me whether Spirit would have remained as, like, this very low-cost carrier into the long term. That doesn't seem like the strategy they were going for.
Well, and this is, I think, the correct critique of the Biden administration policy is not that they caused Spirit to go bankrupt, but that Spirit's bankruptcy, not just the Chapter 7 liquidation that's happening now, but the two prior Chapter 11s, it just like, it calls into question what they were trying to accomplish here.
Yeah.
Because like Spirit was a failing business, right? But it had assets. It had airplanes. It had slots and gates, primarily in Florida. Mm-hmm. JetBlue was interested in buying that stuff. The argument that was made to block the merger was, no, we need this independent, cheap airline with lots of flights in and out of Florida rather than consolidation. But Spirit was losing money.
Yeah.
And so the alternative to them being purchased by JetBlue was to be purchased by somebody else who would also want that stuff, or for them to change their business model to be more comparable to these higher priced airlines, or what ultimately happened, which is that the airline's just going to be dissolved and the planes and the gates will be auctioned off. And, you know, so somebody else will buy them. Probably in the end, JetBlue is going to get a lot of what it wanted out of this, like the material objects, at a lower price because they're not going to need to pay, you know, a control premium. So, you know, in some sense, right, like some of the brainiacs who are involved in this are like, well, so we were correct to block it because this whole merger was like a bad business idea, which I sympathize with. Like a lot of times, I think it's underrated that like a lot of times CEOs want to do mergers simply because it's like cooler and more fun to be the CEO of a bigger company rather than a smaller one. And it doesn't really make business sense. And it's not like an evil monopoly plot. It's just a bad idea. Like when AT&T bought Warner Brothers years and years ago, and it's like, they had this story that they were telling their shareholders. But at the end of the day, being the CEO of like a cell phone infrastructure company is kind of boring. And being the CEO of a movie studio, it like is awesome. You get to hang out with movie stars. You go to the Oscars. They just lost all this money and it was unwound ultimately. So I feel bottom line, like the specific allegations being leveled at the Biden people about this are not literally true. But also, it's really hard to say that like this was an example of this success. Amazing new era yeah. of antitrust policy that was supposed to give us all these benefits. Like, all that happened is the failing airline that wanted to sell itself to JetBlue is now failed and will be sold off for parts. Some of the parts will be bought by JetBlue, some by, I guess, like Breeze. I mean, there's a bunch of airlines out there.
I also think that's like, you know, when I was looking to this, like, it just is clear that there was also some very bad luck at Spirit Airlines, like, was facing. I mean, I don't actually know what this is, but there's this, there's a type of jet engine called a geared turbofan engine.
Sure.
And Pratt & Whitney are the manufacturers of this product, and they had to do a recall. And Spirit Airlines was like the single most exposed airline for this recall. And so like they were able to, they had like Pratt & Whitney had to like pay, I think it was like $130 million, something like that, a year or something like that, in order to compensate Spirit Airlines. But it's like, that doesn't actually like fix the problem. Like, you're not able to sell people.
Well, I mean, this is one of the, you know, airlines are a tough business, right?
Yeah.
So like the mainline carriers fly these very complicated fleets with lots and lots of different types of planes on it. And typically a low-cost carrier will only get one kind of plane, right? And so there's a lot of cost savings for that because you don't need as many spare parts on hand, you know, because it can come in. Your pilots only need to train for one thing, but you are left more vulnerable to something going wrong because you only have one supplier, right? So airlines is a difficult business. A lot of airlines have gone bankrupt over the years. And, you know, Spirit had a nice, like, long run as a business that helped maybe cause some other airlines to have financial difficulties over the years. And that's, like, kind of what competition is supposed to be.
Yeah. And I mean, I was like, a kid before this period, but the 2010s is like right now. It's really normal when you go online and you're like, "Let me go buy like a flight," right? And you're like, "Oh, there's all these different tiers. I don't remember all the names. But, like, there's like basic economy, like super basic economy. There's yeah. like loser basic economy, and then there's like premium loser basic. And like there's all these different ways. And there's you can once you've actually bought your like premium loser basic economy ticket, then you can like decide if you want to spend another $35 on like a seat with more leg room, and then you can also spend another like $15 if you want to like board early and you don't actually have like loyalty points with that airline. And then on top of that, if you want to, maybe on some airlines, if you want to bring more than just one checked bag, you have to pay. Anyway, there are all of these like, there's been a bunch of unbundling that's happened in the airline space, and not just on like the Spirit and the Frontier, but like also on the legacy airlines and on the airlines that are supposed to be like these premium products.
But it was the Spirits of the world that
did
introduced
this. Exactly.
Them.
And I was like too young to remember the time before this, but like this is like in the 2010s really, and Spirit is older than this, but this is when Spirit really starts, and also Allegiant and Frontier really start actually pioneering this new business model. And it's funny, the Delta president at the time, like when all this was happening and they had to, you know, compete with Spirit and Allegiant and all these kind of ultra low cost carriers, the president was basically just like, we're calling it a Spirit match fare. Like, said specifically that basic economy is not something we want to grow. As we've outlined before, it's a defensive product against the ultra low cost carriers. Like, it's like really, really explicit that the actual effect of all of these airlines, these ultra low cost airlines, was like to genuinely produce lower prices for consumers. And it's difficult to tease out because when we think about Delta or United or JetBlue or any of these other airlines lowering their prices in response, and therefore Spirit can no longer compete, and therefore Spirit like has to go out of business, it's like, is that like a win for, it sounds like a win for consumers, but then like obviously there's this question of like when Spirit goes away, what's going to happen? And I think that's like a big part of
Well, and there's also, today. I mean, some of what, you know, drives discourse around this is that ultra low cost carriers came into the market. They offered people cheaper airfares, but they did also offer like a worse product, right? Like what the innovation was.
Typically cheaper things are worse.
Right. Well, I mean, it turns out that for not everybody, but like most people, most of the time, what they basically want is to get to their destination as cheaply as possible.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's been this long-term trend toward creating lower airfares in part by like decontenting the product. And so you'll sometimes see these like nostalgia posts and they'll show you what an airplane was like in the 60s.
Oh my God, we should put that up on the screen. It's like men and women in like the 1960s garb and they're like lounging in these like large chairs. And there's like alcohol being served on this like giant platter and like a roast turkey or whatever.
And the thing is that those fares cost roughly what a business class fare would cost today, right, in a country that was poorer. So you just used to have a situation where many fewer people flied. Airfares were much higher. They were particularly much higher relative to incomes, but the experience was really, really nice. That has now been reinvented as the premium cabin in a mainline airline. And then first, the ULCCs came in and they invented this like cheapo mode of flying. And then the mainline carriers started responding so that now, you know, you can get like economy, mm-hmm. which is like kind of crappy, but then like basic economy, you give up even more and it's cheaper, cheaper, cheaper. And so, you know, the standard neoliberal quote unquote thing to say about this is that like,
way more people get to fly now. I just think it's like,
right.
It's one thing is like the top, we should look this up number, but like a very small slice of American society was like flying commercial in like the 1960s and 70s. Like this was just like the normal flight was like a normal flight for a very rich person. I find this is very analogous to like the college debate sometimes, mm-hmm. like the composition of people who like are attending college today who are considered college educators, just like a completely different composition of people, like way more people get to be a part of this. And so it drives a lot of like weird confusion when, you know, you see the, like, you know, there's pictures of like the 1960s and people are like, well, why is it so much worse now? It's like, no, like the thing you should be comparing it to was like driving across the country. Like you didn't have a flight option because you could not afford to fly.
But it depends, because like one aspect of this that I do think is relevant is that when I was a kid in the 80s, and that was the early days of this, you know, transformation of the industry, my mother worked at Newsweek. She was mostly a graphic designer, photography person, rather than a writer. But Newsweek journalists, like journalists today, traveled for work, you know, fairly frequently. And journalists then, like today, were not treated to like the super premium fares on these things. They had to book regular economy class tickets. But because the worst ticket that you could buy in the 70s and 80s, which is like way better than an economy fare today, like things have gotten way worse for people like that, right? Mm-hmm. If you travel a lot for work, which means you're probably, you know, in the upper strata of American society,
yeah.
but you're not in the like real upper strata of American society. You are now kind of like saddled with this product that has been developed to optimize for the needs of the majority of people who fly infrequently. And when they fly, it's to visit family or to go on vacation. And for them, it's like the upside is that an airplane is much faster than a car. Mm-hmm. And so you can get where you're going and you can do it affordably. And now all kinds of people fly at least sometimes, you know, like just for fun and it's cheap. And in Europe, you know, where people are poorer on average, but also have more vacation days on average. And also, I don't know, this is like more interesting places to go. The ULCC segment is huge on like Ryanair, Jet2Go, EasyJet, things like that. Because you have lots of people who just would really like to, you know, get to Budapest or Warsaw or whatever it is for a long weekend, you know, as cheaply as possible. And it's like, it's crappy planes, but you get there. In America, the market's structurally different. The mainline airlines invented basic economy to defend. And, you know,
it just sets up like a bunch of interesting like trade-offs too, because it's like at some level, obviously, whether it's these, you know, upper middle class people who are now having to buy like basic economy because they're trying to be cost cutting, like people like often have like very little loyalty to like the airline when they go on like Google flights or whatever it is that they do. Like they just pick like the cheapest thing. Often, sometimes they'll discriminate on like non-stop or something like that. But like largely, they're just like, I want the cheapest flight possible. I don't really care if it's, you know, I don't really care if it's Delta. Like some small segment of the population cares a lot because
I care,
you know,
so much. So yeah. I'm clinging to my Starline Silver status for dear life.
But like, I don't like have, I don't really care about that sort of thing. I think I like many Americans, I just sort of, and maybe I'm like, I know I'm leaving money on the table, but it's just like one of those things where I just, you know, you just go for the cheapest thing. Yeah, I'm a woman of the people, Matthew, unlike you. I think the thing that's important about that is that there's almost like a, I want it to be much cheaper than it's ever been, more so than like the technological progress or the increased competition would, or, you know, if you're just looking at the marginal cost of these airlines, like that it would justify. And also, I want it to be this like very luxury product that's available for everyone. And it's like, I also think that's, that would be great. Like it would be a good situation if like we got like higher quality airline tickets and like, or airline experiences and things were very, very cheap. And like, hopefully with like more technological progress, like more competition, like you can actually get access to those sorts of things. But there's like, there's almost like weird dynamic where people both are like really mad at how expensive air travel is. That's like their primary focus. But so much of like the policy discourse is like focused on this, like, is it really annoying that there are all these fees? Or is it really annoying that like, you know, there was this proposal from, I forget what it was, but it was like some airline in Europe to like have like a short standing flight. Yeah, and it was like really treated as like this horrible thing that companies are doing to you. And the CEO was just like, I just think it's like, you can get more people on, it's a cheaper flight for everyone, and you can opt into a higher quality thing if you want to. And so it just becomes this like question of like whether you view companies as largely entities that are trying to like make a profit and like in like any way possible, or if you think that they're like actively just exploitative entities, like regardless of what's going on. But we're talking about
can
all
I,
this.
Can I do my bit now?
You can.
You know, we got to go because I got to put on my tinfoil hat here and talk about what we're really talking about here.
This which is, like, is, did you, how much work? You didn't put any work into this hat. This is not even a hat.
I'm not a crafty person, but I need to, I'm getting paranoid. No. Here's the thing.
How long are you going to keep that on? Just the whole podcast?
We'll see what happens.
Okay.
For a long time now, there has been factional controversy inside the Democratic Party. And one side in this controversy likes to label itself anti-monopoly, or they will sometimes talk a lot about antitrust policy. And Lina Khan is probably the most prominent figure in this sort of movement, but they have multiple policy organizations, Open Markets Institute, American Economic Liberties Project. They've seemingly dominate the Washington Monthly's journalism and have influence over the American Prospect, the New Republic. And these people would like you to think that they are really interested in competition and that like that's the point of all of this. But you see their commentary specifically on the airline industry, which is not the most important industry in the world. But their beef with the airline industry is that there is too much competition. There was a big deregulation of the airline industry that took place in Jimmy Carter's administration that unfolded into the early 1980s and that has unleashed this series of changes where flights got cheaper, the low-end tickets got worse. There have been many airline bankruptcies. There have been a lot of Chapter 11 processes in particular that have not been great for the workforce at the labor unions, at the airlines. And, you know, sometimes an airline liquidates, goes out of business. There was a guy named Donald Trump ran a airline called Trump Shuttle when I was a kid. It would take you from D.C. to New York. It's not in business anymore. I don't know what happened to that guy. And it's this very different world. And Khan herself, you know, she before the Amazon antitrust paradox piece, she had this piece with Phil Longman called Terminal Sickness that said, airline deregulation was a mistake, and they're like blaming like all kinds of things on this, right? Ganesh Sitaraman has a book out fairly recently about how airline deregulation was a mistake. He's one of the big movers and shakers behind Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator. He's like old friends and was a key advisor to Secretary Mayor Pete at the Department of Transportation. Pete, when he was there at DOT, brought one of these people over from FTC to do competition policy there. And it's just like a huge, it's not the most important thing in the world, but like it's a huge tell that the vision that they actually have for the American economy is not that we're going to use antitrust enforcement to make markets be competitive. It's that we're going to use the idea that real world markets don't exhibit like total textbook frictionless competition as a pretext to impose pre-Carter regulatory frameworks on everything.
Okay, let's just back up for a second. Because, so, this is obviously a bit of a different episode than we... hat's coming off.
Taking off the hat.
Taking off the hat.
Getting normal.
It was hard to take you seriously, I'll be honest with you. I was not fully grokking even what you were saying as a result of that. So, tin pot hat wearers out there would really reflect on your choices. I want to take a step back because, like, usually we have an episode where Matt and I, like, are, like, beefing over something in specific. This time Matt has, like, an argument that, like, you know, both of us have, like, you know, general thoughts about Spirit Airlines. But now Matt has, like, a specific argument about how, well, he has a meta point about how, like, this specific episode shows that there's, like, actually this, like, shady plot underlying a lot of the rise of anti-monopoly discourse in the public. And now, just, like, situate people in this who are not so online. There has been, like, a rise of a movement, like the New Brandeisian movement. You might have hear a lot about Lina Khan, who was FTC chair under Joe Biden. But there are lots of people who have been interested in this space. Matt detailed a few of their names. And many of the things they've been, you know, known for are things I think that, like, we would support. Things like, you know, banning non-competes, which I think is actually just neoliberalism. But other things they've been really focused on are around blocking big companies from getting to exist. There's a real fear of bigness. Matt Stoller, who's a big person in this space, his newsletter is called Big. I mean, again, like, they're very, very concerned about, like, big entities existing. Matt Brunig, who writes for our, you know, for The Argument magazine, he wrote this whole piece about how this kind of concern with bigness is not really, you know, that cogent from his perspective as a socialist. But then, like, that, like, entire thing kind of feels, like, very weird in the airline space, which I think is why you think it's, like, such a skeleton key, right? Because in the airline space, what's actually happening under the, you know, pre-airline deregulation moment before Carter, before Nader really takes this on, is that, like, it was a system that, like, privileged, like, legacy airlines. It was, like, literally trying to maintain an oligopoly of airlines that were, like, closely regulated by something called the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board. It's kind of funny because I didn't actually realize it for a while, but, like, the entire conception of the Civil Aeronautics Board, the entire conception, like, the Roosevelt era imposition of this sort of, like, direct regulation of prices and all these other factors that go into airline businesses is that, like, they were worried about there being, like, too much competition.
Right.
There's a theory of, like, ruinous competition that, like, you would have all of these people entering the airline market, all of these companies entering into it. And in order to compete, they would all, like, lower their prices too much such that they wouldn't be able to sustain a business, that these like, you know, these new entrants would drive out, like, legacy airlines out of business. And the whole theory is around this belief that the actual market for airlines can't function normally.
Right. Yeah. You know, the operation of the old Civil Aeronautics Board is complicated, but, like, the key thing is that, you know, if I looked and I said, wow, the guys flying planes from DC to Chicago are making a lot of money, I'd like to take one of my planes that's, like, currently flying around Idaho or something and fly it from DC to Chicago instead.
Yeah.
I would have to go to the CAB and say, I would like permission to start flying planes from DC to Chicago.
Yeah.
And then they would do a market analysis that was designed to ascertain whether or not that market was large enough to support a third airline, or in many cases, a second airline. And, you know, oftentimes the answer would be no, because the purpose of the CAB framework was to prevent the airlines from engaging in price wars that would drive them out of business. And, you know, this was good, obviously, if you were a shareholder in one of those airlines. It was very good if you worked at one of the airlines, because it meant that you never had the experience that many more contemporary, you know, airline pilots, flight attendants and stuff have had of the airline saying, oh, crap, we're going out of business, right? So you had these
and to be clear, this is, like, not like me and I know we had a tinfoil hat earlier, but, like, this is not just like me and Matt just theorizing. This the Federal Aviation Report of 1935 explicitly argues, quote, to allow half a dozen airlines to eke out a hand-to-mouth existence when there is enough traffic to support one really first-class service and one alone would be a piece of folly. So this is, like, an intentional decision. And, like, in 1958, 23 of the 100 largest city pair markets were effectively monopolies. Another 57 were effectively duopolies. And only two did the largest three carriers have less than 98% share. And, like, right. it's like, this was like the thing that we're talking about here, like this kind of regulation was not, this is not like pro-competitive in any real sense.
No, I mean, it was the opposite, right? And so, you know, if you look, there's a Politico piece in which they are profiling Secretary Mayor Pete's conversion to the anti-monopoly cause. And he says in there, like, well, you know, aviation isn't like a regular industry. You know, there's these high capital costs, significant barriers to entry, et cetera, you know, which is true. There are high capital costs and there's significant barriers to entry, right? Like in the deregulated market, you know, I was saying an airline could like shift its planes from Idaho to Chicago, but like Jerusalem and I, we can't just start an airline, right? Like we have both started like websites at different times and it's hard work,
yeah.
But like nobody's going to stop you, right? Whereas you can't.
They keep trying.
For safety reasons,
yeah.
You can start up an airline. It's not illegal, but like it's quite challenging,
yeah.
Right? There's not free entry and exit. So it's true. It's like it's not a perfect textbook marketplace. And so this idea from the 1930s was, well, given that competition would work imperfectly, it's like far too dangerous to allow it to work at all. And so you would have, in many European countries, they just had state-owned airlines, right? That's why if you, like the names of the airlines are like British Airways, mm-hmm. Air France, right? Because they were run by the government. In America, we like believed in capitalism, quote unquote. So these were all private companies, but the government was telling them what they were allowed to do.
Yeah.
But there was this exception, which is that the Constitution was seen as limiting the CAB's authority to interstate air travel.
Before we get into this, okay. I think it's really important. I just want to like point out here, like, I don't want to fully implicitly buy this idea that airlines or like, the airline industry is just like necessarily broken in this specific way. So there's this great paper by Borenstein and Rose. We'll link it in the show notes. But they want to like show that you don't need any exotic, like quote unquote, like this industry is like structurally broken type ideas in order to explain why it is that like airline profits swing wildly and that they just use like kind of like an ordinary, you know, economic macroeconomics model. And they find that just the fact of like the volatile demand, which is like, you know, there are recessions, 9/11 happens, like stuff occurs, like holidays shift around, fuel shocks, etc. But then that plus like the sticky costs that you already mentioned, like labor contracts, whatever it is, and fuel shocks, which we're witnessing right now. Like these three things like perfectly explain this within like the normal macroeconomic, like neoclassical model without. So like even like the presumption that like, okay, there's something specifically so weird about this market that like it's impossible to imagine us regulating it in like a normal way is like, I don't think that well.
Right. Well, and that's why I think the exception to the CAB is relevant. America has, some of our states are quite large. And so there is meaningful air travel demand between the cities of Texas and between the cities of California.
Yeah.
Right. And so in the 1970s, you know, reformers started noting, because it was this theoretical controversy, right? Like how different is aviation from a textbook perfect competition marketplace? It's somewhat different, but like everything.
Right,
exactly. But like, is it really so different in a relevant way? And they said, well, you can look at flying from LA to San Francisco mm-hmm. and compare it to flying DC to Boston, because these are very similar distances. It's similar, like affluent big metro markets. And the intra-California route was way cheaper. Because
and just to put numbers on it, so like the lowest fare between Boston and Washington that was served only by CAB certified trunk carriers was $24.65. I mean, that sounds really cheap anyway, but the Pacific Southwest Airlines using the same equipment carried passengers between Los Angeles and San Francisco, which is only 59 miles closer, for $11.43. The jet fare was only $13.50. So like, that's a huge difference. I mean, this is why the argument for airline deregulation was so strong, is that like you could just look at what was happening inside of these states and just go like, clearly this like regulated market is not providing cheap airfare. And to be clear, like, they knew that? Like, that was, like,
right.
The point? Like, they were raising prices for things that they thought were worth it. And I mean, way above market. And it's so interesting, like the fares they were rising. It was about like 20, the 1972 estimate was that fares were 20% to 100% above competition cost. And you'd expect like, are all these like airlines like raking it in? Like, were they all just making massive profits? They like weren't, which is kind of weird. And they look into it. And basically what's happening is that they're trying to, they can't compete on cost. And so they're they can't control most of the dimensions that like, airlines normally get to control because the CAB was regulating all of those. So instead, they're like competing in other weird ways. So carriers are trying to grab market share by flying more flights than the route justifies. They buy bigger, fancier planes. They serve real meals. They have piano bars on 747s, all that stuff.
Right. This is why the planes were so nice.
That costs money. The craziest part of it is that the single number that captures as well is that by the early 1970s, planes were flying with average load factors below 50%. They were half empty. And today, it's roughly 85%. So, like, I mean, I don't know. I guess we didn't care about climate change then, but like, that seems like quite.
Sure, right. So, you know, this is why deregulation happens, right?
Yeah.
People got concerned about inflation in the 1970s.
Nader
and so
was
they
a
started,
big part of this.
Right,
yeah.
So people started looking at different things. Ralph Nader, at the time, was a big proponent of airline deregulation. Stephen Breyer, who became a Supreme Court justice later, was Ted Kennedy's like policy guy working on this. Jimmy Carter was converted to the cause. A guy named Alfred Kahn was a regulatory economist and, you know, did a lot of like modeling work on like why this would be better. And he was put in charge of the CAB with like a mandate to dismantle it.
Yeah.
A bipartisan law was passed. And this was one of like a number of different things that happened in Carter's term that sort of like inaugurate the era of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the disputes that we have, I mean, it's not, it would be wildly overstated to say that like everything everybody says about Amazon is like just secretly about airline deregulation. It's that understanding, like I think that when the Abundance book came out, I think that a lot of people were surprised that that text took so much fire from the anti-monopoly movement. Because on its face, like a book about abundance and growth seems like it has an obvious potential conflict with at least certain segments of the environmental movement that are like avowedly degrowth. A lot of people, I mean, every like talk, every conference I've seen about this, people are like labor unions, you know, because they like see a tension in economic policy. But antitrust enforcement to like not have monopolies is like just supposed to be pro-growth policy.
And also, right? Like, to be clear, removing the barriers for building new housing typologies and reducing the cost to entry of that market is pro-competition behavior. In California, where they made it legal to build ADUs after like 30 years of laws, you saw like a bunch of new firms enter the market that are like ADU firms.
Right,
and like,
right,
that's
exactly
pro-competition.
If,
you know?
If you're using these words in a normal way, it's not just that like there's no tension between these goals. Like, it's just the same.
Yeah.
Right? Like, all the like abundancy deregulatory stuff, the purpose is to promote competition.
Yes.
All the regulatory anti-monopoly stuff in like a normal universe, mm-hmm, is to like prevent illicit cartels from like privately blocking competition. But the reason, but it's not like this is just some big misunderstanding or, you know, when I interviewed Ezra and Derek about this, I think Ezra was saying like, well, you know, it's like a competition over attention. He's, mm-hmm, really into attention. But like, I think, no,
I think that's
like
part of it.
It's a, sure. But like, there is a genuine, like, big ideological disagreement, which is like a lot of things happened downstream of airline deregulation, mm-hmm, that a person could plausibly construe as undesirable. Like Justice Breyer said, you know, I feel sort of bad about the extent to which workers in the industry ended up taking it on the chin, mm-hmm, as a result of this. I think a lot of journalists wish that their economy airfares got them nicer flights. If the plane was half empty, like that would be really cool. You get some more elbow room, things like that. Longman and Kahn in their article, they outline this theory that, you know, I think is, there's something to it, which is that like in a CAB universe, you would not have been allowed to just like pull metal out of these industrial Midwestern cities and reallocate flights to the growing Sunbelt. And that could have helped prop up the economies of cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati and Cleveland that have been in a state of decline. Now, they put like a ton of interpretive weight on this as a causal factor, but it's just definitely true that if you have this regulator who is like literally telling every airline in America where they can and cannot fly airplanes, that gives the federal government a lot more ability to do like industry, you know, to shape the economy.
But I think important, I like, think it's actually really important because it's this actually is part of this obsession with regional inequality and this obsession with you know, specific places needing to be propped up. I don't hate the Midwest. Don't say that. I like the con piece you're referencing begins with this anecdote of the CEO of Chiquita Brands International, yes, like the banana, like used to be United Fruit Company. It's kind of funny that this is their hero given the sordid history of the United Fruit Company in Latin America and beyond. But basically it is a sad story. It's like he like, you know, he like loved Cincinnati. They'd been there for a while. It was no longer a hub. It was difficult to attract talent. It was difficult to get around business travelers, so they moved to Charlotte. And like, this is like the entire like intro of this piece. And yeah, like
the whole idea of a banana company being headquartered in Ohio is like borderline absurd.
I don't know but the guy was like really obsessed with Cincinnati, and then he didn't really like NASCAR, and like that was like sad and like whatever. And I thought like this is like such a fundamentally conservative position, like small c conservative position, to be like, we think that there are certain places, the places that used to have airline hubs, like, must continue to have them. And like, that's problem. Because like, it's not like there's like a principled thing here where any city that's like the size of X should have an airline, because that would just be like insane. And like right now we have this system, like after the airline deregulation happened, we created these EAS subsidies, essential air service program, in order to make sure that like places would not just immediately lose all of their, sure, their airline access. And it's like the eligibility is basically based on places that had service like over 40 years ago when the industry was deregulated. And so like you have like Ogdensburg, New York, right, 10,000 people.
EAS is about really small towns, yes, going to zero air service. But like the Longman point is just that certain primarily Midwestern cities that were, you know, in the 1940s, among the biggest cities in America,
yes,
used to be airline hubs. A lot of those hubs have been dismantled, and now Charlotte, Miami, Phoenix, Dallas are hubs. And the collapse of population in the city of St. Louis is like a genuine kind of like American tragedy. Mm-hmm. That being said, it's just like, why should the purpose of national aviation policy be to prevent people from moving from St. Louis to Phoenix? Like, if that's...
I do think that the...
I believe in human freedom.
I mean, I agree. I think it's also like that the limiting principle here is actually what gets at like what's weird about this is just sort of like, what is sort of our level at which we're willing to do this? Because it's not just like costless, right? Like all of that, like when the CAB had those prices, they were 20% to 100% over what the competitive price likely would have been. Like that's being paid by people. So the question is not like, oh, don't we think it would be great if someone in Cincinnati had direct flights to like everywhere in the country and international markets as well? It's how much do you think we should be willing to pay for it? And I don't know, like, I think there's like a weird level of disdain that a lot of these people have for the like cosmopolitan elite, despite they themselves being a part of it. Like in the Con article, there's like this line that says, if you are in the business of making and trading stuff beyond derivatives and concepts, you probably have to go to places like Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Memphis, St. Louis, or Minneapolis. And you know how firsthand how hard it has become to do business these days in such major heartland cities, which are increasingly cut off from each other and from the global economy. And it's like, first of all, like your job is trading concepts too. So like, I don't really know where this is coming from. But I think there's also this weird sense, again, like real America is in this place. And like everyone else who lives in like these like high population density, whether cities or suburbs, like everywhere else in the country, like these like fake Americans. I just find like just this is just like a very fundamentally conservative argument.
Yes, but also, I mean, I just find in particular, the discourse here never spotlights the actual trade-off, which is not, yes, just that like, okay, some Midwestern cities lost service and then what? It's right. It's, so it's like there are more flights than ever before in America. The American population has grown and the per capita use of airplanes has also grown.
The decline in prices, like roughly 60%, right, can be attributed to deregulation.
But also, I mean, if you go back to 1970, whenever it is that, you know, Chiquita Banana was in Cincinnati, there were way fewer flights to Austin, way fewer flights to Las Vegas,
yes.
way fewer flights to Tampa, you know? And so it's like, I don't know, you know, it's just like the economy
But evolves. I think this is part of why they're like so hostile to like sort of YIMBYism, because a lot of when you look at like the YIMBY original economics literature, it's focused on the innovative capacity of agglomeration, right? Like part of what's going on here is that folks like, you know, Ed Glaser and other economists, Moretti, et cetera, are looking at like the agglomeration of people in places like Los Angeles or these superstar cities. And that's like a positive thing. Like that's like innovation happens in these places. New firms get developed, new ideas, like cities are really great engines of opportunity and economic growth. And, you know, like all of these cures for things come out of these hubs or whatever. And that's like not because there's something just like special in the water in like Silicon Valley or whatever. It's like they're like a lot of people who are together, and like that just creates much more potential for new ideas to flourish. It also lets people start new firms in a place where there's like a thick labor market for the types of people that they are like trying to hire for and from. And all of this, like there's like hostility to this attitude is like kind of a sense that like that's actually bad. That like everyone, I was at this, like I did this panel once, and it was like a Chatham House rule, so I can't be very specific about it. But like I was just like talking broadly. It was just an interview. I was just like, talking about like, you know, all the benefits that kind of accrue, like doing my normal shtick about YIMBYism and agglomeration and economic growth. And like there were just like a lot of these kinds of people in the audience.
Right.
And they were just like, they didn't care about the lower cost. They didn't care about the innovation and the benefits. It was like, no, it's fundamentally bad that there are all those people agglomerating in Seattle and DC and New York. That's just bad.
But I just also, you know, read some of this in the other direction, right? Which is that like part of the whole argument around the CAB, right, was, well, this technocratic analysis will give us like a better outcome than the slightly messy. David Ox has a good article about like competition in the airline industry. And what's true is that, you know, essentially because planes are so big, right, you can only compete in these kind of giant chunks, right? It's not like it's hard to compete on the margin. So there's a tendency for an individual market to sort of lurch between somebody's reaping big profits here to now everybody's losing money. And it's odd. It's kind of jarring. And so you could have like an expert regulator just like make everything be smoother. But like, would that happen in real life, right? And I think just an obvious thing that might happen is some airline might say, way more people live in Austin today than used to, but fewer people live in St. Louis than used to. So instead of my plane going from Chicago to St. Louis, I want to send it to Austin.
Yes.
And then the senator from Missouri is going to be like, fuck no. And so then you like can't allocate the airplanes correctly.
I mean, this literally happens right now with EAS subsidies. Like there's a study that shows that the subsidies are the biggest in cities represented by elected Congress people on the House Transportation Committee.
Yes, yes. I mean, it happens all the time when you have this kind of regulated function. So now I want to quote Phil Longman 2025 article about this. And he says, it's not hard to imagine, for instance, politicians from both parties who represent quote unquote flyover cities banding together to demand more equitable, affordable, and practical air service through a new regulatory regime, perhaps one that takes advantage of AI and other modern data processing tools to make pricing and other regulatory functions more precise than under the old CAB system. I think that's incredibly naive, whatever, whatever. But to be clear, the guy who has this take about how we need to do central planning, right, and that we're going to use AI to make the central planning really good, his job title is that he's policy director at the Open Markets Institute. And like, this is why I'm so in on my tinfoil hat, because I think that a lot of people are genuinely confused as to like what this debate is about.
Yeah.
Because if it was called, if Phil Longman's organization was called the Central Planning Institute, and the American Economic Liberties Project was called the Technocratic Regulators Can Improve on Market Outcomes Institute, then nobody would be confused.
They'd
be
why
like,
they were beefing with like, abundance.
Like, why do the advocates of central planning dislike this mild-mannered like zoning change?
Yeah.
And we could say, like, listen, we are like having a debate, right? It would also help explain why this is a debate like inside Democratic Party politics, right?
Yeah.
It's a debate about whether what it means to be a center-left political party should be to be like a capitalism and welfare state party, or it should be a central planning party.
And as it's an aside, I do actually wonder whether AI makes like the Hayekian argument that like you can't actually have a regulator that knows enough to essentially plan properly, whether that actually really undermines that.
I mean, I think this is a really important debate that we should discuss at some point. And this is like, do you know Francis Spufford's book, Red Plenty?
Oh, yeah.
Because that's like kind of what it's about. It's like, can we make central planning work with better computers, right? But like, that's what
I think the problem here is that like, it's not even, I want to be clear, like there's so many normative assumptions baked in. It's not even just central planning, which I think is like also like part of what's going on here. It's also like, you could do central planning for the purpose of like maximizing efficiency and output. Like you could like have like a goal of saying like, okay, we actually would want these planes to route to places where there's high population centers. We do like the fact that there's like this growing industry in Silicon Valley. And like, we do think that like Charlotte is clearly a growing hub for whatever reasons, and like biotech and like, the research triangle or whatever it is, and like we're going to like do central planning for the purpose of like maximizing growth and output, but like they have a specific normative judgment, right, that like actually there is a specific, I don't know, it's like a nostalgia for this way that the economy looked at this particular point in time under like New Deal prominence. And it's not even just the specific policies, it's also the fact that Cincinnati was a major city. It's that Detroit was a major city. Like, these things are, like, very important to them for some reason. And, like, there's so many normative judgments about that that I think that are, like, really unstated, which is, like, hey, like, efficiency is not just, like, a, you know, annoying technocratic term. It, like, speaks to the fact that, like, everyone gets to pay less. And I just think it's, like, really weird that in this moment of, like, affordability, where, like, inflation is, like, the driving concern that people have in the electorate on both the right and the left, that, like, this movement, which is, like, quite literally objectively about, like, raising prices for the purpose of paying for things that they think are worth it, is, like, trying to cast itself as, like, this, like, affordability hero. And I'm, like, I don't know, like, seems
well,
wrong.
I mean, again, like, this is why I think the tinfoil hat is necessary, because it's like the whole watchword of affordability is interesting, right? Because like in a literal sense, right, like, can I afford, you know, this laptop, right? That's a function of the price of the laptop and my income.
Yeah.
So affordability is just economic growth, right? Like when there's economic growth, there is more affordability. So why do we have to obsessively invoke the word affordability, right? And it's like, well, because if you get people to not think about economic growth and you just like get them on some other track that's like affordability, then like maybe price controls is the answer.
Well,
right?
I think also that there's like a short-term problem. Like economic growth, correct, is like the fundamental driver of affordability, but like it does so like not tomorrow.
Yeah, right. We're right. But I mean, it just means we're not having a conversation anymore about like the long-term and the short-term and inflation and blah, blah, blah. We're like letting all these other ideas in through the back door, right? So like theoretically, the idea of the CAB price control regime could be to prevent people from, you know, exploitation at the hands of airlines, right? Like when there happens to be an oil price shock, you know, that's not the case. But again, like Longman's article is full of this idea that like people are getting gouged and that passengers are suffering. And like, you know, none of it's true, because he is asserting that like the failures of the CAB system are down to the amount of computing power that exists there, rather than that like this is a fundamentally unsound way to run an economy. And this practice that like Buttigieg was invoking in the Politico article of just kind of like spot the deviation from, you know, like total undifferentiated commodity and then be like, now we're bringing in the central planning. Like, it's like a really bad way to make economic policy. And
we also haven't
I know
talked-
that I sound crazy, but it's like, I really need people to understand that like these are not disputes about like, are monopolies good? Or like, should the government enforce antitrust rules? It's disputes about, do we want an open competitive market in which companies fail, in which companies try to reduce labor costs and other things and succeed? Or do we want to create this, you know, regulated economy that, yes, like lets us put forward alleged social goods, like, you know, we want to prop up the economy of Cincinnati, and even things that I would agree are good, right? Like, you could steer toward, like, greener aviation if you were controlling every aspect of the system. It's just, like, it's incredibly costly.
I also think that to me, the real tell of all of this is when I started doing some research on what happens in other regional markets. Like, the U.S. is one of a handful of major aviation markets that combines, like, two of the most protectionist policies that are, like, obviously anti-competitive. One is a ban on cabotage, which is, like, foreign carriers can't fly U.S. points. It was fly between two U.S. points. And
right, so, like, Emirates can't go, like, Dubai to New York, then New York to L.A.
Exactly.
And then back around.
And also, there's a hard cap on foreign ownership of U.S. airlines, 25% voting stock, 49% equity. And, like, you combine that with the fact that Chapter 11 lets, like, weak U.S. carriers restructure rather than die, and you get, like, a system that's, like, really, really good at keeping the existing four players. And I looked to see if there was, like, any evidence that, like, any of these people in the anti-monopoly wing of this party have, like, really come out against, like, cabotage and, like, for allowing foreign airlines to compete. And, like, it just, like, doesn't exist. Like, in the EU, for instance, starting 1992 through, like, 1997, they have, like, they've created a true single aviation market. So, like, 20 years after we do it, they, like, do a bunch of liberalization of their own airline industries. And then, like, that creates, like, real competition. So, like, Ryanair, EasyJet, Wizz, Vueling can base aircraft and run domestic routes anywhere in the EU bloc. And that result is that, like, the top five European airline groups control about 45% of the market versus 80% for the top four in the US. And, like, I'm just sitting here like, okay, like, I like to take people at face value. I don't like to read a lot into what they're saying here. But, like, it is very weird to me that, like, perhaps the single biggest unlock, not just for lowering prices for consumers, but also for, like, raising competition, is, like, basically unspoken by the anti-monopoly wing. I think in large part because they're, like, really aligning themselves with very much more, like, nationalistic elements of U.S. policy and politics. But it's, like, it's just, like, bizarre. And I don't know, like, I think also, like, when you look at the European market, like, it's just, like, at some level, I'm, like, you know, there's this belief that, like, you know, the fact that Spirit goes bankrupt, the fact there are bankruptcies in U.S. airline industry all the time is, like, really bad. It's, like, okay, like, I don't really know, like, if I have this something in my head about how much bankruptcy is okay, like, why, like, how much does it hurt consumers? Like, my question, I don't really care if a company goes bankrupt generally. But, like, airline death in Europe is, like, really routine. In the last few years, Alitalia, Flybe twice, Norwegian's near collapse, Monarch, Thomas Cook, Air Berlin, WOW, Primera, Cobalt, Flyer, Play, Brathens. I mean, these are all going bankrupt.
Because if you think about a competitive market, right? Yeah. I was just to be like, wow, over the past 10 years, a lot of restaurants in America have closed. You'd be like, sure.
Yeah.
And a lot of restaurants open.
Yeah.
Right? And, like, in a recession, more restaurants close than open. And in a growth cycle, more open than close. But it's just, like, that's what competitive markets are like. That's what anti-monopoly is.
And there's, like, a legit paper about bankruptcy and pricing behavior in U.S. airline markets. Ooh, from AER. Fancy. I have all my papers, Matt. I did my research. Matt does not want me to fact Max so much. He wants less fact.
I don't approve of facts. I'm all theory.
But, like, they look into what actually happens when a carrier enters Chapter 11. They find that fares dip briefly. Healthy rivals often don't follow. And when bankrupt airlines abandon routes, competitors fill the slots quickly. They find no statistically discernible service decline at small or large airports when a carrier with operations there enters bankruptcy. So if the whole point of anti-monopoly is to be focused on the consumer and, like, consumers having fewer, lower prices, better experience, like, whatever it is, like, if that's, like, literally what's happening here, then, like, why do they care so much about whether there's bankruptcies? Like, and I think that to me, this brings back my point about, like, this fundamentally conservative nature of this movement, because it's just, like, there's this, like, sense that, like, the existing institutions have to be protected. Like, the specific things that are going on right now, or, like, the 1970s or the 1950s, the 1930s, whatever, like, that was, like, good. And, like, we have to, like, get back to that. And it's just, like, I don't know, like, I'm not sure, like, if it's better that more people live in Detroit than live in, like, Washington, D.C. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's, like, freedom is good. People can make decisions.
Shots fired. Should we move on? Do peer review?
Yes, peer review. So, peer review is a segment of this podcast where Matt and I look at an interesting new white paper.
Yeah, you kept wanting to quote academic research in the main segment, and it ruins it.
I want you to know.
This is when we're talking about it.
You got to fact max all the time. Like, theory doesn't take you all the way. This is an interesting paper. So, this paper is about whether intra-household bargaining power shows up in what couples buy, and whether gender-specific labor market shocks shift consumption toward whatever spouse got like the better outside option. They like do these like two natural experiments we're looking at. Like one is like the industrial robot adoption, which disproportionately displaced men in routine manufacturing. And then they also look at the fracking boom, which also disproportionately raised wages for less educated men. And they find that a standard deviation increase in robot exposure narrows the male-female spending gap by $20, 4% of the mean, shifting away from male-coded goods and toward female-coded goods. So basically, like, as men are getting fucked over by the economy, or male-specific jobs or male-exposed jobs, or labor markets are more likely to be messed up, like, in the household, spending shifts towards like female coded goods.
Right.
I guess like the theory here is obviously like the literal market power within the household is like
clear,
shifting towards women.
It's not just, you know, people say coded all the time now, but like what they actually do is they look at what do single men and what do single women buy.
Yeah.
Right. And so then they show that when then they look at married couples, right? And so within a couple, if like men's earning power declines, the household consumption starts to look more like the consumption of a single woman. And then with fracking, it's the opposite.
And I mean, you can read this like a lot of different ways. One thing that's interesting about the paper is they find that the effect is stronger in like college educated couples, which indicates to me this is like an egalitarian mechanism when you're looking at the power of women going up. And so like, you could just imagine, right? Like a world where there's like, you know, you're talking about the 1950s, 60s. Last week, our episode was about Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. And you have like a male earner and he like controls the money and like he has a bank account and the woman maybe has like specific access to parts of a budget. So like more of the budget is literally just controlled by the male spending decision. So even if like at the grocery store, you're making choices between two different things, like maybe the guy is buying, making those decisions more so. But like in a world where women are also earning and now maybe earning more in some cases, or at least are like earning more relatively to their previous market positions, like they now have more power. So it's like potentially an interesting story. And I think it's interesting from an AI perspective too.
I mean, I guess my quibble, doubt, I don't know, something about this, right, is when I think about intra-household bargaining over this kind of thing, I feel like, I get why they did the paper this way, because, you know, always when you're trying to do empirical research, you need like a tractable question, right? But this kind of shift from like boy stuff to girl stuff, it's probably smaller than the question of who is actually making decisions around genuinely joint expenses, right? So like so much stuff isn't gendered in that way. Like single men, single women have refrigerators. They have stoves. They have cars, right? We're spending, you know, all spending money on this stuff. And then couples buy that stuff together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we reason together and we reach a mutually agreeable decision.
Hopefully.
But like, clearly, I mean, like, you know, on an informal basis, like somebody is getting more say than somebody else over these kinds of calls. And I feel like that's where the bargaining is to some extent most intense.
Yeah.
Precisely because it has to be bargained.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if the thing is, I mean,
you're not going to have two fridge. Two
right.
Fridges, yeah.
And, you know, different people just manage.
I don't know. Rich people have like that garage fridge.
Sure.
Which I learned about. You can
always, I have two fridges. You can always manage these things in different ways, right? But it's like if you have a two-earner household, maybe, you know, both people just have some of their own money and then they have some pooled money. And so, sure, it's like, if one person in the household starts making more money, maybe they're like totally discretionary expense. You know, I don't know. I don't know what do men buy. I'm like buying more scotch or something. But you know, the bargaining is like you actually do need to reach an agreement about like your couch, your fridge, like which house do you buy?
I do think too, like the part that was perhaps most most concerning to me was the impact on marriages and on fertility.
Mm-hmm.
So shocks favoring women shift consumption and they also destabilize marriages. And shocks favoring men shift consumption weakly and they raise fertility within existing unions. And like, there's like a not creepy way of like interpreting that, which is that like men are get wealthier. Maybe the woman's able to like now stay at home and have a kid without having some kind of like problem with their like earning, right? Like shock favoring men increasing the number of children.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, if shock favoring men ends up increasing the fertility, that could be like a positive. Be like, oh great, honey, you got a raise. Like now we can have like a kid, right? Like that could be good. But like it indicates to me that also like that like women are. I think that the fact that shocks favoring women destabilize marriages indicates that they're like unhappy women in marriages who like without money are not able to leave their husbands. The other interpretation is just that like in a marriage, men and women need to like bring things to the couple for like stable relationships to form. One of which is like you should be employed and like have a job and like it's important to care for the family. And so like it's like really bad that like when someone loses their job or like maybe like, you know, the fracking boom, et cetera, like that sort of thing like will break up households because like the number one financial stressor in marriage is finances. So like there's like lots of ways to interpret this data.
Well, but wait. Let's give due credit to everybody for just being normal here, because the
was that not normal?
No. Just because the shocks that they had, right? The male favoring shock is a positive shock.
Yeah.
Right? It's like because of fracking, now working class men can earn higher pay. The female skewing shock was a negative shock, right? They don't have in the study the question, what happens if something occurs that raises women's...
But it's like shocks favoring women relatively.
We don't know what would happen, right, if you had the opposite, like fracking for ladies. You know, and so women's earnings just go up, right? Now, one thing that could happen is that could destabilize marriages. Maybe with their greater earning power, these wives are like, fuck it, I don't need to put up with this guy and his bullshit anymore. But it also could be that it's like the male earnings boost. And they say, now we can afford like a nicer stroller, you know, or more car seats or, you know, babysitting. And so we should have more babies. Like we just honestly don't know. Like the research doesn't answer
that. It's in the table. It's in table 8A of the paper.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you went to the table, Matthew.
I didn't see the table.
You didn't see the table.
What happens in table 8A?
You're not fact-maxing enough.
I'm not.
Basically, there's a one standard deviation increase in robot exposure produces a 3% decline in the marriage rate, a 13% increase in divorce, and a 6% decline in the number of children.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that's a negative shock to men. It's not a positive shock to women.
Oh, I understand what you're saying.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
So we just don't know.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
But I mean, like, this model implies some stuff.
You don't think so? I've been pushing to do the gender slop argument with you.
This isn't gender slop.
For a long
time. These are facts.
Yes, these are facts. I mean, this is the way of the world.
All right. If you guys want to hear a gender slop podcast, no, we're not going to give you any more information about what that means. Shoot us a note.
No. Wait. I want to go back to the joint purchases, though, because, you know, we talked about Feminine Mystique last week. And, you know, one of the things Friedan is really geared up about is like how much products are marketed mm-hmm. toward housewives, right? Because at least like her perception of the 1950s economy is that even though women had like very little like financial control under that paradigm, they were the people making the purchasing decisions about all these appliances and things like that. And that's why, you know, there was so much like marketing focused on them, which is just to say, like, it's why I think that without looking at the balance of decision making over genuinely joint purchases, we're not like really plumbing the depths of what's occurring here. We're really just seeing that, like, if people have more money as an individual, they do more individual discretionary spending rather than fully sharing it equally with their spouse, which is interesting, but I don't know.
Matt's really faithful to what we can know, and I'm trying to go by beyond that to the theory. What happened to theory?
I love theory. I just think we already knew from theory maxing that I don't want no scrubs, and so if industrial robots render you unemployable, like
it's gonna be a problem.
You're gonna have problems in life. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The Argument. I will see you next week.
Well, please like, subscribe, share the podcast, tell the world we need to purchase discretionary consumer goods here.
Yes, we do.
Bye.
Bye.